My name is Ian Miller, and I am a coastal hazards specialist for Washington Sea Grant. And I work on a variety of coastal hazards issues, including climate change, chronic erosion, and then obviously recently this issue of the potential impact of debris from the Tohoku tsunami has come up in a big way. And so I focus some attention on that, and in particular trying to define the potential range of impact, in particular for managers. I wanted to provide some context for managers about how much debris we may expect, and obviously I focused on Washington State because that's where I'm based.
What prompted you and your colleagues there to take a look at it? What was the thing that forced you to take a look at it in a big way here? Was there a specific event of debris washing ashore, or was it something else?
Well, it was more the uncertainty that the washing up of just a few isolated pieces caused. There was seemed to be a lot of anxiety when some of the first material washed ashore, rightly so. And really, we saw very limited information out there that could be used to provide any real quantitative context for the amount of debris that we might see. And so instead, what we felt like was dominating the discussion was sort of kind of people's imaginations. And it was especially based off of some of the photos that emerged immediately after this tsunami of these enormous rafts of debris just offshore of Japan. And it really struck us that it seemed like those images were driving a lot of people's, I guess, perceptions of what may make landfall on this coast, on the other side of the ocean. And so we wanted to try to examine the available oceanographic literature and just to see if there was anything in there that would help us to provide some context, some scientifically backed estimates of how much debris may come across the ocean, how would it likely travel, where would it likely make landfall, that kind of thing.
We've seen numbers ranging from as much as 1.5 to 5 million tons of debris coming across, and that leaves a lot to the imagination right there.
Absolutely, and those are the estimates that were put out by the Japanese government after the event. The 5 million tons was their estimate of the total amount of debris washed into the ocean after, what we should all remember, it was a truly horrible event. And then the 1.5 million tons was their estimate of the amount that, of the 5 million tons that washed into the ocean, that's the fraction that actually floated away, they think. Now, it's important to remember that, one, it's hard to visualize that kind of mass. And so that just causes some anxiety and uncertainty to start with. And second, those are just estimates. I'm imagining. I don't know how the Japanese government derived their estimates. It's simply we got them from the NOAA website, which attributes them to the Japanese government. But, my suspicion is that it was kind of based on some estimates of what sort of the number of houses that were missing from certain towns, the number of vehicles, that kind of thing. So there's probably a lot of uncertainty in that actual number as well, which we talk about in the report.
Even if that figure is accurate, though, not all of that is expected to wash ashore or come across the Pacific, though, is it?
Absolutely not. What we did is we looked at the available published oceanographic literature, most of it peer-reviewed, and used it to make some assumptions about the amount that might make landfall on our side of the ocean. Our research, our literature review, suggested that the dominant part of that debris, of that floating debris, may never even make landfall. There's a lot of research that suggests that most of the debris that enters the Pacific Ocean, the North Pacific in particular, ends up in the North Pacific Convergence Zone. This area, this huge area of the ocean that's known sort of colloquially as the garbage patch, and that's where most of that debris is going to end up, based on published oceanographic literature.
Is that essentially what is kind of like a dead zone, a whirlpool in the center of the Pacific where everything gets stuck and not carried away by currents going either way?
Yeah, more or less. You can think of it as a whirlpool, although it's huge. It's vast. And so, you know, it's not really you can't sort of think of it in the same way that you think of your toilet flushing and seeing that kind of whirlpool. It's a huge area of the ocean. But it is an area that, by virtue of the rather slow but persistent and huge movement of large-scale ocean currents, drives debris into this area and tends to hold it. Some cases I've seen the garbage patch characterized as, or almost visualized as, an area like where debris is just coating the surface and you can almost walk on it. The research suggests that's not at all what it's like. It's an area of very distributed debris, but it is an area that seems to collect and converge and collect and hold debris. And as far as we know, based on the literature that we review, it holds it for forever in perpetuity until it typically breaks up or sinks.
How much is expected to reach the various shorelines of the Pacific Northwest?
So what we estimated, based on a couple of different sources, was between 2 and 25% of that floating mass, of that 1.5 million tons, that between 2 and 25% would come ashore. And that was based off of really two sources. One was empirical information, most of it collected by or published by Dr. Curtis Ebesmeyer, who's a well-known sort of marine debris expert. He has sort of talked about this 2% rule, which is more or less comes from his observations of the number of items that he's tracking. He mostly tracks items that are lost over ships, cargo containers of shoes, or he's got a few famous cases of tracking things like rubber ducks or toys. And in those cases, they can know how many toys or shoes were lost over the side, and then they can count how many are found by beachcombers in the, along the shores of the North Pacific Ocean. And so that sort of empirical evidence suggests that usually you find about 2% of the items that were lost over the side. So we use that as kind of our lower range. We said, well, 2% seems like a reasonable estimate. The 25% came from observations of drifting oceanographic drogues, these tools that oceanographers use to study large-scale ocean currents, and they're essentially thrown into the ocean. There's a network of some, if I recall correctly, around 14,000 of them that have been distributed around the global ocean since the 70s. And those drogues are designed to sort of float just below the surface, and they're designed to track ocean currents. And we relied heavily upon a particular paper that was published by Rick Lumpkin, who's a physical oceanographer with NOAA. And he asked an interesting question of those drogues. He said they're usually used to find out where they flow in the ocean, but there's a certain percentage that are always lost, either because they are picked up or hit by ships, or because their batteries die. They transmit their position occasionally, and so they have batteries in them, so their batteries die after a couple of years, or because they run ashore, and they can generally infer which ones run ashore by their last broadcast position. And so he published a paper looking at, the group of drogues that have run ashore, where have they run ashore? And we relied upon that heavily, and looked particularly at the data that he derived for the North Pacific to make some inferences or assumptions about where debris from the tsunami may also run ashore. So that's the approach we took. That's where the 25% came from. He estimated that about 20 to 25% of the drogues released in the global ocean run ashore. And so we use that as the upper limit. So that's the information that we have. The downside is that especially that drogue data, it's got two big problems. One is that it averages the location of washup over time. And we know that in the North Pacific, year by year, the climate is different. There's climate cycles operating in the North Pacific, changes in wind patterns, So in any particular year, the pattern can look very different than the long-term average. So that causes a lot of uncertainty. No surprise, we know there's uncertainty in our estimates. And then the other issue is that those drogues are not designed to be blown by the wind. And we know that at least some of the debris has what we call windage. It's exposed to the wind, and that changes how it may travel. And that's also something that introduces uncertainty into our estimates.
And what would happen to the other 75 to 98% of the debris? Would it perpetually be recirculated, or would it sink?
So based on the literature that we reviewed, we believe or think that the bulk of it would end up in the North Pacific Convergence Zone, this area of the quote-unquote garbage patch, where it appears that over time, a lot of the debris that's entrained in there, and this isn't only tsunami debris, this is a lot of the debris that enters the ocean, the volume and weight of which probably swamps what was introduced into the ocean from this one event. But it looks like a lot of that stuff eventually is broken down and sinks or just breaks into ever smaller pieces.
And it looks like, based on your research here, that some of the debris that, or at least a large portion of the debris that does wash ashore is expected to be along the Alaska shoreline.
Yeah, and that is based largely off of this paper published by Rick Lumpkin, which suggested that drogues in the North Pacific preferentially or washed up in larger numbers in Alaska than along the stretch of coast essentially from Vancouver Island south. And so that's where that came from.
Why just in that particular area?
We don't know exactly why that is. Some of Dr. Ebbesmeyer's work perhaps suggested why that is. There is a gyre that rotates in the Gulf of Alaska, but it rotates in an opposite direction from the gyre that entrains debris in the convergence zone, in the quote-unquote garbage patch. And as a result, so when debris gets entrained in that gyre, what may happen is that instead of sort of collecting in the center and being held, it actually sort of gets, I think of it in my head as being sort of flung out from the center of the gyre. So that's sort of one mechanism that could explain. So when stuff gets entrained in that gyre, instead of getting trapped, it sort of makes a circuit around the gyre and every once in a while is sort of thrown off onto the shores of the Aleutians and Alaska. That's kind of the simplistic, I guess, interpretation that is in my head. And that's largely based on some of his work that he's done tracking items, tracking either toys or shoes or whatever, suggests that there's a periodicity. There's two debris landings. So if they're tracking a particular kind of item in Alaska, they'll often see that they'll get a spike every couple of years. And that may be from stuff getting entrained in the gyre in the Gulf of Alaska, and every couple of years, like a new sort of like, it'll come around again and stuff will make landfall.
It really sounds like this type of ocean science is, I guess, relatively new over the last 3-4 decades or so.
Well, certainly in terms of tracking debris, it's been a question that oceanographers started to struggle with based on our review of literature maybe in the 80s or 90s. And certainly this event has brought it to the forefront. It's very interesting. A lot of the oceanographic models that are used to sort of try to assess where the debris field is now, some of what NOAA publishes, for example, or some researchers like Nikolai Maximenko out of the University of Hawaii, those models were often built for entirely different purposes. They were built to track ocean currents, for example. And applying them to the problem of debris is complicated because debris, as we talked about before, has varying degrees of windage. And so it may respond totally differently than we would expect if the debris was being driven by sort of large-scale ocean currents alone. And so, so it's a very interesting problem. And from my standpoint, obviously it's a potential hazard to have debris in significant quantities wash up on the beach. And that's something that, I know a lot of people are working on how to respond appropriately to it. But it's also a really interesting scientific story. Where this debris washes up. And I know that there are people, Curtis Ebbesmeyer is one of them, who are trying to track and understand where and how much particular types of this debris wash up.
Has this report been used or cited or referred to by those who say, well, perhaps maybe there is not that much debris coming this way, and perhaps there's maybe not really that much urgency into devoting funds for shoreline cleanup?
You know, unfortunately, we found that there's simply too much uncertainty to provide any real, to narrow our ranges, you know, for each. We estimated these ranges of debris that could be expected, and we tried to focus on Washington as much as we could. And those ranges were huge, and they were, you know, our upper limits of the range are significant quantities. We estimated that our, quote-unquote, debris baseline here, so the amount that washes up sort of normally outside of an event like this one that introduces a big pulse of debris into the ocean at one time, is about a half a ton per mile per year. And based on the ranges that we published, we suggested that we could see well over 100 times that amount from this event. So that's significant. That's not something to be ignored. The low end of the ranges suggest that it might be just as little as twice that amount. And so that range is huge, and that's a lot of uncertainty. So it hasn't been used, as far as I know, by anyone to downplay the potential impacts of this debris. However, I have gotten good feedback from exactly the intended audience, the managers, particularly in Washington State, although I've gotten feedback from people in Oregon, managers in Hawaii, that really sort of appreciated, it sounded like, the way that we tried to go about coming up with these ranges. Because prior to that, really, it sounded like there really wasn't a lot of good quantitative information that managers could use to start to answer or at least discuss basic questions like, how many dumpsters do we need to have on certain beaches? How many volunteers may we have to mobilize? Those are the kind of questions that we were trying to help managers grapple with.